Support for this Kansas News Service podcast and the following message comes from the Kansas Leadership Center, offering leadership development training in Wichita, Kansas City, Topeka, and online. Inspiring leadership for the common good. KansasLeadershipCenter.org.
Well, my fellow Kansans, here we are again, deep into an election season that virtually everyone agrees will be another decisive chapter. The tug of war over what Kansas should be.
I'm pumped, and I'm ready to get busy working on the general election.
Democratic nominee for Governor Laura Kelly, she's pumped in kind of an understated Kansas way, and so am I, because there's a lot on the line, some big questions. Will voters return Kansas to its practical progressive roots, lead us down a new independent path free of divisive party politics, or keep us traveling down the road we've been on for the last decade, that road to a redder red state? I'm Jim McLean, your guide for this running conversation about the 2018 election and the events that delivered us to this pivotal point. I've covered politics for public radio and newspapers for more than 30 years, and rarely have we had so much to talk about. This is My Fellow Kansans, a podcast from the Kansas News Service.
From the start.
Yet another lie,
Commissioner.
From the governor.
Yes, this is a podcast about an election, but we won't spend a lot of time talking about who's up and who's down in the governor's race, or which of the candidates said the most outrageous thing on Twitter or otherwise.
It does look like it's at this point a Kobach Kelly smackdown.
Let's get underneath all that, dive deeper to explore the powerful but sometimes hidden forces that shape candidates, supercharge issues, and affect our elections. Still with me? Okay, good. On this first episode of My Fellow Kansans, we'll do a couple of things to kind of set the stage for what's to come in the coming weeks between now and Election Day. Some basic things like introduce the candidates for governor. I'll do that in just a minute. But I also want to get into the DNA of Kansas and its politics. Not too deep, just talk a little bit about what makes Kansas, Kansas. You know, that stuff about its free state beginnings, its symbolic reputation as the real America. That black and white but welcoming, homey place that Dorothy and Toto want to get back to. That stuff is both imagined and real. And it's all important to our politics. It's what native Kansan Thomas Frank trades on in his famous, or depending on your point of view, infamous book, What's the Matter with Kansas? A book in which he argues that a kind of reverse populism changed the state.
When What's the Matter with Kansas came out, I got a lot of criticism from people who thought, well, you know, your views are so odd. Your politics are so out of the mainstream that you can't be a real Kansan. And the funny thing is, I feel like I am deeper in the Kansas grain than all of these right-wingers who rule us today because of that populist tradition. Those are my people.
Frank rarely does interviews these days about the book that put him on the literary map in 2004, but he talked to me about it, so of course I'll have a lot more of that conversation coming up. But before I get to that, let's dispense with the introduction of the main characters in this year's election drama, the candidates for governor, and talk about where they fit into Kansas's political traditions. Five candidates will be on the November ballot, including a couple of long shots. Jeff Caldwell is the Libertarian Party's nominee, and Rick Clues is a self-described frustrated Republican. He's running as an independent. The Democrat in the race, Laura Kelly, well, she's no long shot. She's a longtime state senator from Topeka.
I represent an urban area, but I also represent a lot of rural. And my Senate district is 10 points plus Republican. A Democrat has to appeal to all different kinds of Kansans. And I think we've been able to do that just because we have common sense, moderate, thoughtful approaches to public policy.
Kelly isn't the first Democrat to play it down the middle and put an emphasis on working across party lines. That's pretty much the Democratic playbook for Kansas. She's following in the footsteps of former governors like Kathleen Sebelius, John Carlin, and Bob Docking. He was a penny-pinching Ark City banker who occupied the governor's office for four terms in the 60s and the 70s.
Ladies and gentlemen, I consider this an austere but adequate budget.
Austere but adequate. It's a phrase you still hear around the State House during budget debates.
We share a joint responsibility to give our citizens quality services rendered effectively, efficiently, and economically.
Laura Kelly says stuff like that when she talks about the damage that, she says, former Republican Governor Sam Brownback's tax experiment did to the state.
Much of what makes Kansas so special has been under attack for the last 8 years. The cuts to our public schools have done harm to so many, and it was all to pay for tax cuts for those who needed them the least. It's wrong, and I'm running for governor to fix it.
Well, in 2018, so is Greg Orman.
It caused us to underinvest in our kids, our infrastructure, and by definition, our future. It led to two credit downgrades, a doubling of our debt, and punched a multi-billion dollar hole in our budget. It was the definition of fiscal irresponsibility.
Orman is a wealthy business owner from the Kansas City suburbs who ran a decent but unsuccessful race for the U.S. Senate in 2014. He looks every bit the part of a traditional, moderate Kansas Republican, but he's not. He's running as an independent. He wants to break free of party rule and get back to more practical, less ideological politics.
The future is not found in the failed promises of partisans, but rather in the freedom and courage to embrace a new path. Because I want to go forward without the yoke of partisanship to a future that is good for all Kansans, I'm running for governor as an independent.
So, we've got an independent contender, Greg Orman, and a viable Democrat, Laura Kelly. And then there's the candidate who's on Fox News so often he deserves his own time slot.
Chris Kobach is the Secretary of State of Kansas, and he joins us tonight. Mr. Kobach, thanks for coming up.
Great to be with you, Tucker.
That's the Republican nominee, Chris Kobach. In the GOP primary, he billed himself as the most conservative candidate in a field of conservative candidates. If elected, he'd keep Kansas headed right on Brownback's red state roadmap.
Long-term issues. If I'm your governor of Kansas, you'll have conservative results. Number one, we will cut taxes. Number two, we will end illegal immigration in Kansas. Number three, we will protect unborn life in Kansas. We will end the culture of corruption in Topeka, and we will be the number one state in protecting gun rights in America.
Thank you. Kobach is now the guy conservatives are counting on to continue their domination of Republican politics. He's been Kansas's Secretary of State for the last 8 years, and he's used that office to build a national reputation as a hardliner on illegal immigration and voter fraud. Kobach entered the GOP primary as the favorite, and he won, beating out incumbent Governor Jeff Collier, who stepped up when Brownback left for a job in the Trump administration. But Kobach's margin of victory in that primary was among the smallest in state history, a fraction of a percentage point, only 343 votes.
First and foremost, I want to thank the Lord above for carrying us through on this victory.
An endorsement that arrived via Twitter on the day before the election just might have been the difference maker.
Hartman and his wife, Libba. And in particular, I would like to thank the President of the United States, Donald Trump, for his endorsement both during the primary and again reiterated this morning with a tweet endorsing us in the general election cycle.
Kobach draws frequent comparisons to Trump because of his never-back-down style, and he likes that.
In it to win it in Kansas. You know, he's a great man. I think he's already making history as a president. Few would be hard-pressed to dispute that he has had the greatest impact since Ronald Reagan, at least in recent presidential history.
Kobach may be cut from the same conservative populist cloth as Donald Trump, what Thomas Frank calls reverse populism. But when it comes to Kansas's political DNA, he's an outlier. The state's center-right Republican tradition has been embodied by a pretty long list of Kansans who rose to national prominence. William Ellen White, Alf Landon, his daughter, Nancy Landon Kassebaum, Dwight Eisenhower, and of course, this guy.
Ladies and gentlemen, delegates to the convention and fellow citizens, I cannot say it more clearly than in plain speaking. I accept your nomination to lead our party once again to the presidency of the United States.
Bob Dole, the Kansan who overcame terrible wounds suffered on a snowy Italian mountainside in World War II, to rise almost to the top of American politics. He, more than anyone else, says University of Kansas political scientist Burdette Loomis, exemplifies the particular strain of Republicanism that dominated Kansas politics for so long.
Yeah, I think that you have a few people to look at. But I mean, I think the key practitioner over the course of the 20th century has been Bob Dole.
Dole, Loomis says, was a conservative who believed in containing government, not crippling it.
He didn't reject government, and you know, indeed, he was almost fatally injured working for the government in World War II. He was rehabilitated by the government. He lived in a farm area that needed government subsidies, on and on and on. Cut the great deal on food stamps and in the farm bill. And to me, he represents this kind of fairly conservative but not crazy Republicanism.
American politics was just starting to harden when Dole captured the Republican nomination for president back in 1996. Compromise was becoming a dirty word, but not to Dole. He could be fiercely partisan, no doubt about that, but he made his reputation working across party lines to get stuff done. Things like the Americans with Disabilities Act and legislation that made it easier for millions of hungry Americans to put food on the table.
And to those who believe that I live and breathe compromise, I say that in politics, honorable compromise is no sin. It is what protects us from absolutism and intolerance.
That deal that Dole struck in the late 1970s with George McGovern, then one of the Senate's most liberal Democrats to preserve and reform the food stamp program, well, it continues to be held out as an example of how politics should work.
This bipartisan legislation revolutionized the program and made the program more efficient and more accessible to the poor by finally eliminating the requirement that Americans pay for a portion of their stamps.
If you didn't have, you know, that money to put up, then you weren't eligible for the program. It didn't make any sense to me.
That's Bob Dole, the original compassionate conservative, with all due respect to George W. Bush. Part of Kansas's political legacy also belongs to non-politicians, thought leaders like William Ellen White, the reform-minded publisher of the Emporia Gazette, who early in the 20th century was known as the Sage of the Heartland. He spoke out against the Ku Klux Klan when it wasn't a popular thing to do, and he championed several of the progressive causes of his friend, President Theodore Roosevelt. White believed an educated electorate was essential to a functioning democracy. He said a voter armed with knowledge of history and, quote, the fields of human activity, unquote, could be counted on to resist the inevitable siren song of the demagogue.
He will not mistake kindness for cowardice. He will not find himself suspecting everyone and believing everything, for curiously and paradoxically, the fool is always suspicious and credulous. Those two qualities go together.
Well, in case you didn't quite catch it, White, in that rare surviving snippet of tape from 1938, so the fool is always suspicious and credulous, a fancy word meaning gullible, naive, unwary. Depending on your point of view, you might see White's concern about gullible voters as prescient. So, what pushed Kansas politics to the right? There's no argument that it happened, but there's plenty of disagreement about how and why. Thomas Frank has wrestled with those questions. Coming of age in the affluent Kansas City suburb of Mission Hills, he was a devoted supporter of Ronald Reagan. But that changed soon after he set foot on the KU campus and discovered the massive Gothic structure known as Watson Library.
I remember wandering around in that library one day, and I came across an entire shelf of books. With the same title, they were all the same volume, the same, you know, and it was The Populist Revolt. It was a book published in 1931 by a guy called John Hicks, once upon a time a famous history of populism. So I pulled one down and started reading it, and lo and behold, it's about Kansas. It's about stuff that happened here, and I had never heard of any of it before. A light went on in my head that has never gone off, which is that all of this kind of the populism of Reagan, the populism of the market, is this stuff that I'm reading about turned on its head.
Reverse populism, that's the thesis of Frank's book, which, remember, takes its title from one of William Ellen White's famous editorials. Frank argues the seismic shift in Kansas politics was driven by politicians beholden to big business who use the populist power of cultural wedge issues, mainly abortion, to hoodwink working-class people into voting against their economic interests. There have been plenty of naysayers, but almost 15 years after the book's publication, Frank says he thinks that argument still holds up. I talked to him recently when he passed through Wichita promoting his latest book, a collection of essays called Rendezvous with Oblivion.
As our country, you know, went further and further down the road towards this free market paradigm, very predictable things followed. As you destroy organized labor, for example, the lives of working people suffer. Inequality grows. Small farmers get hurt. All of these things were absolutely predictable from the get-go. And here they were happening. And this is a democracy. And we were letting them happen. And not only were we letting them happen, we were voting for them. And so I needed a place to write about it. And I didn't want to do the South. And Kansas was perfect for a bunch of different reasons, because I knew about it. You know, I've obviously grew up here, very familiar with the state. It didn't have that Southern legacy, so you couldn't brush it off as a leftover of Jim Crow or something like that. And also because it had turned, or was in at that moment.
Turning.
Yeah. This is in the late 90s and early aughts.
Yeah, post-Reagan, but it was starting to turn.
Right, right, right. It was abandoning the sort of Dwight D. Eisenhower Republican Party and making its bid to be the Sam Brownback Republican Party. And I could watch it happen with my own eyes. It was fascinating. And the thing that triggered it, I was living in Chicago and I opened up the newspaper there, the Chicago Tribune or whatever, one day, and they had a big story about Kansas fighting over the theory of evolution. And I could not believe it, because that's not the state I grew up in.
Let's just make it clear, though, you didn't start from a neutral premise. You had made the conclusion that this turn toward unbridled capitalism was a mistake.
Absolutely. So I'm not acting as a neutral journalist in this. I never do. I think that's in like the first 10 pages of What's the Matter with Kansas. However, that said, the book is not a by-the-numbers attack on right-wingers. And I think that's what distinguishes it from, I mean, there's now an enormous body of work on this kind of subject, usually attacking, mocking, deriding the people who vote for right-wing candidates. And that is not what I did.
But he argued they'd been sold a bill of goods by politicians who made empty promises to turn back the clock on the cultural and economic changes that were rocking their world.
And that's where populism comes in, and the kind of reverse, the culture war right-wing populism that is everywhere around us today. But Kansas was, in some ways, was way ahead of the rest of America in this regard. You know how Trump and Bannon, and it's so cynical and manipulative, but they like to talk about the Republican Party becoming a workers' party. And that's what I described in Kansas way back when, and happening in the 1990s. Yeah. So the sort of party of Nancy Kassebaum, Bob Dole, Dwight Eisenhower, Bill Graves has slowly but surely become something very, very different.
I want to just go back to page 254 in your book here. And you talk about this, you label it backlash conservatism.
Yes. That's one of my term that I made up.
It says, "The hallmark of backlash conservatism is that it approaches politics not as a defender of the existing order, but as an average working person offended by the arrogant impositions of the liberal upper class. The sensibility was perfectly summarized during the campaign by one-time Republican presidential candidate Gary Bauer, who explained it to the New York Times like this: Joe Sixpack doesn't understand why the world and his culture are changing and why he doesn't have a say in it."
Yeah, you've put your finger on the essential subject, that this is not a conservatism of complacency. It's not country club conservatism. It is a conservatism with a grievance.
You say frequently that people who are aggrieved by things, the degradation of our culture.
Well, what Gary Bauer says, he's exactly right. I disagree with Gary Bauer on every issue. But when he says Joe Sixpack wonders why his world is changing and he doesn't have a say in it, yeah, that is the story of our times. The world that we grew up in is disappearing. The sort of middle class society that we all loved, that I was born into in the 1970s or in the 60s, is vanishing before us. It's crumbling. And the conservatives have figured out a way to harness that anger without really doing anything about the economic basis of the grievance, about what's happened, what's actually happened. I mean, they make that much worse. That gets worse all the time, you know, as they cut taxes and defund the state and wreck unions and deregulate and all that stuff. That world that we were born into crumbles more and more and more.
As I mentioned earlier, a lot of people take issue with Frank. They believe there are other reasons for the shift from Landon and Dole to Brownback and Kobach. And we'll hear from them in later episodes. But there's virtually no disagreement on what set things in motion, what triggered the political changes in Kansas.
Friday, 8-2, approximately 8:19 a.m., Dr. Tiller's attempt to enter the clinic. Gate is blocked. The protesters have been informed that they should move and disperse and are not doing so.
1991 Summer of Mercy abortion protests in Wichita.
It was a huge deal. We never expected the crowd that came from all over the country to Wichita.
They had to bring out buses. They brought out rider trucks or rental vans one day because there were so many protesters to haul off.
We're going to continue to pray and we'll be here a little longer.
We're petitioning God. We're petitioning God to change the hearts of the people of this country.
They took control of the Sedgwick County Republican Party. They were out of the pews, into the streets, and then into the political arena.
The group plans to take its pleas all the way to the Democratic and Republican National Conventions next year.
The point that the Summer of Mercy changed the political landscape of Kansas is 100% true. And you're standing on the ground where it happened.
The prairie fire that ignited a conservative uprising in Kansas, next time on My Fellow Kansans.
My Fellow Kansans is a production of the Kansas News Service, a collaboration of KCUR, KMUW, Kansas Public Radio, and High Plains Public Radio. The podcast is written and reported by Jim McLean, edited by Amy Jeffries, and mixed by Matthew Long Middleton. The production team includes Beth Golay, Nadia Foe, Scott Cannon, and me, Grace Lotz. Primary Color Music composed our theme, and Jordan Kirtley designed our logo. Reporters Madeline Fox and Stephen Bisaha contributed audio to this episode. Special thanks to Neil Carruth of NPR and the NPR training team. If you liked this episode, subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes. It helps other people find our podcast. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at KS News Service.